Okay, so today I'm going to tell you about some things I've done using the Cactus computing framework to look at some questions in quantum gravity. And one of the general messages that I'll attempt to convey is that supercomputing, and in particular computational frameworks, can be potentially quite useful to gaining new insights into the predictions of existing quantum gravity theories. Today I'll be talking about three projects in particular. One is with Stefan Zorin at Imperial, another is with Seth Major and Sumati Surya at the Hamilton College and the Raman Research Institute, and the third is with Johannes Brunemann at Hamburg, and in addition, of course, the Cactus development team. Okay, so I'll start off by saying a few introductory remarks about what is Cactus and what is a supercomputing framework. Then I will talk about some work we've done in studying how entropy bounds may arise from discrete quantum gravity. Then I'll discuss some work in trying to deduce how continuum information, for example, continuum topology, may arise from an underlying discrete order. And then lastly, I'll talk about some work I've done in computing the spectrum of the volume operator in loop quantum gravity. And then I'll wrap up with some conclusions. So first of all, what is Cactus? Cactus is a generic, freely available, modular, portable, and manageable environment for collaboratively developing parallel, high-performance, multi-dimensional simulations. So this is a framework that was developed originally to solve problems in numerical relativity involving binary black holes, and is now a quite general framework which can be used to address a wide variety of problems. As I mentioned, it began in numerical relativity, in particular with the binary black hole grand challenge. It involved a large collaboration of researchers, and it was important for them to be able to develop modules which could be used independently. In a sense, if they're properly designed abstractions and interfaces, then these modules should be able to plug and play and work together seamlessly. So this is the general principle of Cactus. And so the idea then is that a physicist should not have to change their code even if some underlying technology changes, for example, message passing or some fancy new grid technology or whatever it is. I should say the basic design is of a flush, using the Cactus analogy, which is some code written in C which allows the modules, which are called thorns, to all interoperate cleanly. So some of the features, it allows collaboration in one sense, instead of passing source code to collaborators, now one can specify what the code does by a parameter file. Another aspect it has is a web interface, so it's possible there are thorns which cause a simulation to launch a web server, so different collaborators can connect into it. Another important aspect is cooperation, in that it allows one to inherit the developments of others. So if someone puts a lot of work into developing some very efficient software to solve some problem in quantum gravity, then anyone else who uses the framework then can take advantage of that software. And this can also be done by computer scientists developing something for parallel I/O or whatever might be needed. And so the general idea is to build up a community code base for addressing problems in various areas of quantum gravity or any other field. And furthermore, the idea is to some degree, to insulate the physicist from sort of thorny problems, if you will, for doing large-scale simulations. Okay, so I want to emphasize that Cactus can be useful for quantum gravity computation. So it's not just about solving PDEs on a fixed lattice. The great advantage of it, I think, for quantum gravity and for many aspects is modularity. So each physicist can write their code in terms of modules, and Cactus takes care of making sure that they all work together. These modules can be written in the language of your choice, which is very useful. In many collaborations, each person has their own favorite language, and they're generally not the same. I mentioned this earlier. And then, again, so the idea is to be able to share code and build up a community code base. There exist sizable code bases for numerical relativity, and now there's one for causals like quantum gravity. And so a general question is, could we then do the same for loop quantum gravity or spin foams or dynamical triangulations? Some further advantages are portability. It takes care of issues of porting to new machines, automatic parallelism, and so forth. Okay, so now I will say a few words about how entropy bounds may arise from causal set quantum gravity. So first of all, let's imagine some isolated matter system of mass E and of entropy S matter. If we just do a naive quantum field theory computation of the maximum entropy we may expect that the system could possibly have, then we essentially end up with something that's proportional to the volume of this region. Okay, but we know that this, in fact, is not possible when we take into account gravity. And one way to see that is via this Susskind process, which I'll describe now. So as I said, we have this isolated system, which is circumscribed by a sphere of area A. We have an approximately spherically symmetric metric in order for the sphere to make sense. We also have to assume that the asymptotic conditions are such that we can form black holes, and also that the matter system has to be stable on time scales longer than the square root of the area. Otherwise, it would just collapse immediately into a black hole. And so the idea then is to take a spherically symmetric shell of mass root A minus E and carefully collapse this onto my matter system such that I form a black hole of area A. And then by the generalized second law, I start with a total entropy, which is just that of the matter system plus that of the shell. And the final state is simply that of a black hole whose entropy is A over 4. So combining these, I see that the entropy of my matter system can be no more than A over 4. And this is, of course, much smaller than the naive prediction of an entropy bound which is proportional to the volume. Okay. Covariant entropy bound is a more general one, which is developed by Bousseau. The idea is as follows. We consider any codimension 2 surface of area A and consider any congruence of null geodesics, which is everywhere orthogonal, which emanates from that surface and is everywhere orthogonal to it, and furthermore is everywhere non-expanding. I'm sorry, it's orthogonal and is everywhere non-expanding. We call that a light sheet. And the statement of the covariant entropy bound then is that the entropy on that light sheet must be less than A over 4. So here's a simple example of a one-dimensional surface with a future ingoing light rays shown here. The idea is to emphasize that the surface B does not have to be a closed surface. Okay, so the statement is that the entropy in this sheet must be smaller than the length of that surface over 4. Here's another example of a black hole. If I consider, say, a surface just outside the black hole horizon, then I see that if I consider the path-directed ingoing light sheet, then all the inflowing matter which forms the black hole must cross that surface, and therefore I get a derivation of the generalized second law. So all this is leading to something like a holographic principle, telling us that the region which is bounded by an area, is bounded by something of area A must be described by no more than A over 4 degrees of freedom. So it's suggesting that there's some universal connection, which is caused by gravity, between geometry and entropy or information. And so the question is then that I'm going to attempt to address is there some potentially underlying explanation arising from space-time discreteness for this, for these entropy bounds? Before I talk about that, I want to review very briefly the causal set program. It's based on two observations. One is the fundamental need for discreteness, for example, because of the presence of singularities or the finite black hole entanglement entropy of a black hole. And the other observation is the richness of causal structure. So it turns out that, for example, given a past and future distinguishing space-time, just the causal order is sufficient to reproduce the conformal metric. And so if I combine these two, if I can combine the conformal metric with discreteness, and I can, the discreteness can give me the missing volume information, and I can expect to recover the full geometry from just the discrete causal order. So just to give some definitions, the causal set is a set endowed with a binary order relation, which is irreflexive and transitive. So these encode the causality, and then furthermore, it's locally finite, which simply means that every order interval, the set of elements between a pair X and Z, say, must have finite cardinality. Okay. So I've said that very quickly that we expect a causal set, some discrete order relation, to underlie spacetime. So then the obvious question is, how does the continuum spacetime emerge from this underlying order? The idea is via an embedding, which is an order-preserving map from the causal set to the spacetime. And if I further refine this notion to a faithful embedding, which is an embedding which furthermore preserves a correspondence between number of elements and spacetime volume. So the idea is that a faithful embedding should have the property that the number of elements of the causal set that get mapped into some region of spacetime volume V should be Poisson distributed with the mean volume of V. And a further condition is that the scale of geometry in the manifold M here must, scale of geometry change must be larger than the mean spacing of the sprinkling density. So there can't be structures that are at scale smaller than the sprinkling density. Okay, so then here's a picture of a faithful embedding of the causal set into S1 cross time. And I show here, you can notice the random, the Poisson distribution of elements here. And in green, I've shown the causal relations, or in fact, the irreducible causal relations of the causal set. And one thing you notice is that because the Poisson sprinkling is a Lorentz invariant process, then what I end up with is a Lorentz invariant lattice, in a sense. And in order to achieve this, then what happens is that the vast majority of these causal, irreducible causal relations are almost null. And so we end up with if you think of it as a graph, it has an extremely high valence. In contrast, here is a picture of a regular light cone lattice in red here. And then in green, I've taken the same lattice and boosted it by 4/5. And you can see that in the boosted frame, this lattice is not a very good approximation to the causal set. Or saying it the other way, this continuum spacetime is not a good approximation to this regular lattice. Okay, so by the way, how much time do I have? When am I finished? Say again? Okay, great. So, I want to make the following proposal for how entropy bounds may arise from causal set quantum gravity. So the idea is to consider a spherically symmetric space-like hypersurface sigma of finite volume in a strongly causal spacetime of dimension greater than or equal to 3. And consider a causal set C which is faithfully embedded into the future domain of dependence of this region. So I want to imagine a causal set which is faithfully embedded into this region here. And the proposal is that the maximum entropy associated to this space-like surface sigma is given by the number of maximal elements in this region. Or a maximal element of a causal set is one which has nothing to its future. Okay, so and then I make the claim that this proposal then will lead to the Susskind entropy bound in the continuum limit, that the maximum entropy can associate with some region is given by the area of its boundary divided by 4. Okay, so there are two ways to compute the number of maximal elements. One is analytically, so I can use properties of the Poisson distribution to write down an integral in d-dimensional Minkowski space for the expected number of maximal elements. The integral is just the sprinkling density times an integral over the future domain of dependence here times a volume factor times an exponential, which is the exponential of this green region here, the future of a candidate event X intersected with this region. And so this is the probability, this exponential is the probability that the region in green here is empty of sprinkled points, which is equivalent to the statement that this element x here is maximal. I can also compute it numerically using the causal set toolkit. The idea is very simple. I just sprinkle elements into this future domain of dependence for the Poisson distribution, deduce the order relations, and then count the number of maximal elements in this region. And to give you some feel for what this looked like, so here's a picture of a causal set embedded into the future domain of dependence of a two-ball in three-dimensional Minkowski space, where I've shown the maximal elements in green here. And one thing you may notice, so I'm making the claim that the number of these green elements should be proportional to the, essentially to the circumference of this circle in Planck units. So you might expect then for that to be true that the maximal elements should bunch themselves around the perimeter of this thing, but they do not. In fact, they tend to congregate towards the center. So as we'll see if this works out, it's a very non-trivial result. It's not at all obvious why the number of maximal elements in green here should be proportional to the circumference of this region. Let me make one other comment. So, you might be asking yourself, where does this proposal come from? So if you imagine some matter system sitting in sigma, we know that eventually it must travel, it must cross this future Cauchy horizon at some finite point in time, and so you might imagine that the number of maximal elements here is some limit on the amount of information content that could be stored in this matter system. So this is a physical motivation for why we may expect such an entropy bound to work. Okay, so in three plus one dimensions, we can write down an analytic expression for the number of maximal elements in terms of a generalized hypergeometric function. For large n, the asymptotic behavior of this function turns out to be simply proportional to the square root of n. If I define a Poisson embedding at unit density in fundamental units, and I compute the volume of a cone of radius r, then I can rewrite this expression in terms of n, in terms of r in Planck units. What I end up with is some coefficient times 4 pi r squared over 4. And so what I can do then is choose a fundamental scale such that this coefficient here goes to 1. In fact, if I choose the fundamental scale to be the 4th root of 6 times the Planck scale, then I end up with the prediction that the maximum entropy should be proportional to the area over 4. So let's see how well this works. So this is a plot of the red here is the analytic result, this generalized hypergeometric function that I showed you. The green is the result of the simulation, and the blue here is the asymptotic form, which gives me exactly this behavior that I mentioned, that the number of maximal elements is proportional to the square root of the number of elements n in the causal set, and therefore is proportional to the area of the boundary. So I'm getting perfect agreement with my prediction. Another test is to consider not flat slices, but to consider spherically symmetric hyperboloidal slices. So I consider slices which have the same boundary sphere, but yet are curved, and in fact of a hyperboloidal geometry, which is parameterized by some coefficient A. And I here have a plot of the results. So for various values of A, so different degrees of curvature of this slice, I find again that in the asymptotic regime of large sprinkling density or large number of elements, that each of these curves tends to converge to a curve, to the statement that the number that, well, the number of maximum elements is proportional to the area of the boundary divided by 4. Okay, and this again is a non-trivial result because you may imagine, if you will, for a moment, that the maximum elements you expect will tend to be bunched towards the top of this diagram here. And I know that the boundary sphere is the same, so you may think, well, because the volume is different, then if we look here, if this volume changes, then when I work through this calculation, I'll get this coefficient to be different. And you might expect that I need to introduce a different value of fundamental scale in order to get this correspondence to work out. But it turns out that, in fact, somehow the number of maximal elements conspires in such a way that I exactly get the same fundamental scale, even with these curved slices. Okay, next I want to say some words about looking at how a continuum topology may emerge from a causal set. So, first of all, let me mention that temporal notions, such as proper time, are easy to extract from a causal set. So if I imagine a pair of elements, Z and W, which are time-like related in a causal set, then it turns out that I can predict the time-like separation between Z and W in a faithful embedding by simply counting the number of links in the longest chain connecting the two. A chain is a set of elements for which every pair of elements is related. Spatial notions, however, are more difficult to deduce because of Lorentz invariance, and because, in a sense, because of this infinite valence of the lattice that I mentioned earlier. So if I consider a pair of elements x and y, which are space-like related, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, it turns out that it's not difficult to deduce the space-like distance. What I can do is simply consider a pair of elements which is in the future of both x and y and in the past of both x and y, and measure the time-like separation there, and that would give me a good measure of the spatial separation. But if instead I try to do this in 2 plus 1 dimensions, what happens is that if you imagine boosts in the direction orthogonal to the screen here, then you'll get pairs W and Z which can be very far separated. And since this is an infinite Minkowski space, eventually you'll find such a pair that the number of elements in between them is zero. And so you'll end up with a prediction that the spatial distance is zero for every pair of elements. So the potential resolution for this problem is to make a local selection of a frame, something which we call an inextendable antichain. So an antichain is just a set of elements in the causal set which have no relations among them. An inextendable one is simply one which can't be extended. There's no other elements of the causal set which can be added to it such that we still have an antichain. And so this is something like an edgeless space-like hypersurface. Every element of the causal set must be related to some element of the inextendable antichain. Here's a picture of just an arbitrary inextendable antichain in a causal set, which is again faithfully embedded into a circle across time. So you might think in some sense this is like a Cauchy surface because of this edgeless character, but it cannot possess initial data, for example, because the only intrinsic information in the subcausal set is simply its cardinality. And so then you may ask, can we use the neighboring causal structure to deduce which elements of this antichain are nearest, are spatial nearest neighbors, and then start to build up some spatial information? Excuse me? Half time. Okay, thank you. Okay, so a way to do this is to define something called a thickened antichain, which is just a subcausal set, which works as follows. I start with my initial inextendable antichain, and then consider each element to its future, and for each element, compute the past of that element intersected with the future of the antichain, and if that is less than some parameter v, then I consider that part of the thickened anti-chain. And so if I perform this thickening for a V of, in this case, something like 17, then I end up with a subcausal set, which looks like so, where I've drawn in addition, the irreducible causal relations in this thickened anti-chain. If I consider a much larger example, and here I have the another picture of a thickened anti-chain, one of the features that I want to point out to you is that, so if you look at if you look at the bottom surface of this thickened anti-chain, you might notice that it's somewhat jagged. It's quite a rough, it has many segments which are almost null in the frame of this picture, but the top surface is quite smooth. So in effect, this thickening process has some smoothing character, which is reminiscent of a Ricci flow. And this can, in fact, be important, as I'll mention in a moment. Okay, so then one thing we'd like to do then is compute spatial information from the causal set. And perhaps the simplest thing to start looking for is homology. So can we compute the homology of the continuum spatial slice from these thickened anti-chains? And the idea is as follows. I take each of the maximal elements of my thickened anti-chain, so these are the red elements here, and I look at the intersection of the paths of each of these with the minimal elements of the thickened anti-chain, which are the green elements in the picture here. And so what I end up with, if I look at these intersections, I get a cover of my initial inextendable anti-chain. And so if I compute the nerve then of this cover will give me a simplicial complex, and from that I can compute the homology of the space. So just to remind you, a nerve works as follows. I assign a vertex in my simplicial complex to each set in my cover, and furthermore, if I have q sets in the cover which intersect, which have a non-vanishing intersection, then they form a Q minus 1 simplex. So for the simple example here, I get this funny-looking simplicial complex. This is just a brief review of simplicial homology. The important point is that so the homology groups are the cycles modulo the boundaries, and the Betti numbers, which I'll be computing in a moment, are the dimensions of these homology groups. So for this simple example here, the zeroth Betti number is 1. It's simply telling me that I have a single connected region. The first Betti number is also 1, telling me that I have a non-trivial cycle of dimension 1, and all the higher Betti numbers vanish in this situation. And let me remind you then that the cover and thus the homology will vary with the thickness V. So just to go back to this picture, if I thicken a little bit further, then these maximal elements will go further up in the causal set. Therefore, these shadows will get larger, and so we'll end up with a different cover, and therefore a different simplicial complex and different homology groups. And so what I'm going to show you in a moment is how these homology groups vary with the thickness. Before I do that, let me mention that we proved the theorem, which essentially goes as follows. If we have a causal set and a globally hyperbolic spacetime with a compact spatial slice, and if furthermore there's an inextendable anti-chain in the causal set, which is contained within this slice sigma, then if I have an appropriate separation of scales, which I won't go into right now, but then it can be shown that a thickening to some volume parameter n in this range has a homology of space via this nerve construction. And so the question is then, will we find anti-chains which have these properties? And intuitively, it seems obvious that the more smooth anti-chains are those that would be more likely to work properly in this situation. And so this smoothing property that I mentioned, something like a Ricci flow, could be instrumental in locating inextendable anti-chains that will have this property. So the suggestion is that these conditions on the theorem are quite minor, and we can explore this question numerically. So I start with a picture of the situation where I have S cross I. So I have a circle cross an interval. The vertical axis here are the Betti numbers of various dimensions, and the horizontal axis is the thickness parameter. If I start with if the thickness parameter is zero, then I just have my initial antichain, and I have the zeroth Betti number is huge. It's just the number of elements in my inextensible antichain, and all the other Betti numbers vanish. As I thicken away from that, then I start to get larger connected components, and eventually I end up with a single connected components, which shortly afterwards, the first Betti number becomes one, and all the others vanish. So we may recognize this as the homology of a circle. So I'm in fact reproducing the correct homology of the circle for a large range of thicknesses. And this is the sort of characteristic of a causal set which embeds into a spacetime that we should expect to see. Then when I thicken too far, eventually I get beyond the convexity scale. So these shadows become larger than the convexity radius of the spatial manifold. And when that happens, then strange things come in. I start getting higher homology groups. But eventually then, when I thicken far enough, you can imagine eventually there will be an element which contains the entire inextendable antichain to its past. So we call this the cosmic scale. When I get to that point, then it's certainly true that I will get just a trivial homology with where H naught is Z and all the remaining homology groups vanish. So for this simple example of S cross I can see this full spectrum of possibilities. If I consider a more complicated example of 2 tor S cross I get a similar situation. So the zeroth Betti number starts at very large and comes down. The first Betti number initially grows, and then when I get to my stable region, we see that beta 1 is 2, as we'd expect for 2 torus, and beta 2 is 1, and so I get the correct homology for the significant range of thickenings. This is a similar situation. It's the same 2 torus cross I as in the previous example, except I've taken the case where one of the diameters in the 2 torus is much smaller than the others. And in fact, I've chosen it such that it's smaller than the sprinkling density. And so what we see then is that for the stable region, the first homology group, H1, is Z instead of Z2. So what's happening is that we're in effect seeing a Kluze-Klein type situation where there's a compact dimension which is not seen at the scale which is probed by this by the sprinkling. The last example that I want to mention is transitive percolation. I don't want to go into too many details, but this is a dynamically generated causal set. And one of the features that we notice is that there are a number of regions of stable homology, which suggests that, in a sense, there's some space-time-like feature of the causal sets generated by transitive percolation. And if you have some imagination, you might... So these are the zeroth Betti numbers in red here. So what's happening is that as I thicken further and further, then I'm getting larger and larger regions which are connected. And so in some sense, it's reminiscent of the early universe, where as I go far enough in time, then I get then more regions are causally connected. Okay, so let me now finish up with the last part is to talk about the volume operator and loop quantum gravity. I won't spend too much time talking about this since Thomas described it to us on Tuesday, but essentially we have the kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity is the basis is given by these spin network functions. And turns out that by the theorem of Peter and Weyl, we can describe these in terms of spin states. And the action of these electric field operators can be reduced to that of angular momentum operators on spin states. And so this is very useful for analyzing the spectrum of the volume operator. So the volume operator in the classical theory, it's just the root determinant of the metric. If I write it out in terms of the electric field, I get something like so. And turns out that then it can be decomposed in terms of a spin network as a sum over spin network vertices of some expression, which at each vertex is a sum over triples of edges emanating at that vertex with some coefficient, which is just the determinant, the sign of the determinant of the three edge tangent vectors times some matrix QIJK. So these signs are telling us something from the graph structure. It's some information from the graph structure that's coming in and affecting the volume spectrum. The second part, this matrix here, is contribution that's coming from the values of the spins on the edges of the spin network. And so what I have, in general, I have a vertex V with this is an n-valent vertex. I have a number of edges which are incident on it. Each of these edges has a spin. And so what I need to do is build up a tensor basis of angular momentum states. And I can use the Krebs-Gordan theorem to expand this and recouple the perform a recoupling. If I use this recoupling basis, then I can compute the values of these matrix elements, and I end up with some expression like so. If I again consider my vertex with n edges incident on it, each of these has a tangent vector. And so if I consider a triple of these tangent vectors, then I get, if I compute the sine of the determinant of these three tangent vectors, then I get these epsilon sine factors. So in general, for every triple, LMN, then I'll have some sine, which comes into my volume computation. But you might ask, are these all realizable? So you'll end up with to actually realize these signs for some embedding into a three-dimensional space, we end up with a system of n choose three inequalities. And so the question, first question you might ask is what sign combinations can occur at all in three-dimensional space? Now it turns out that if we impose gauge invariance, then I can write the volume operator in such a way that I can combine the signs for a given triple in terms of these quantities which we call sigma, which you can see are just going to be between minus 4 and 4. And so what we end up with is a sum of Hermitian matrices, one for each triple of edges incident at the vertex, with varying prefactors. And we can ask what sign configurations can be realized at all, what are the consequences of gauge invariance, and what we're seeing then is that there's some contact between the coupling of spins and the properties of three-dimensional space that's coming into this volume spectrum. So what we've done is computed, so for each valence n, we've computed, so this here is just n choose 3, the number of triples for that valence. This is the maximum number of signs you might imagine assigning to each of these triples. So for each triple, if I compute this one of these epsilon signs, I get a plus or minus. So this is the number of maximum possible signs you may get for each triple. This is the number of sign combinations which can be realized in three-dimensional space. We computed this by sprinkling on a unit sphere and just counting all the number of sign configurations which arise in the sprinkling process. And this is simply the fraction of the number of possible, number of theoretically possible sign configurations which are realized. Here we have the number of sigma configurations, where sigma is just this combination of four epsilon signs. And in this last column, I've simply shown the number of sigma configurations that are zero. So this can be zero for certain sign configurations. So there are certain embeddings of network, spin network vertices which have zero volume independent of the values of spins on those edges. And so now I'll show you, so we've computed the spectrum of the volume operator for all of these realizable sign configurations that we've computed. And for the five vertex now, this is a plot of the largest eigenvalues that arise. This horizontal axis is it's a sigma configuration index. So for each value, each index on this horizontal axis, we have one collection of sigma values. So for one collection of these epsilon signs. And on this y-axis, we have twice the spin on the vertex, and the vertical axis is the volume eigenvalue. So this is perhaps not so surprising. We simply see an exponential growth in the value of the volume eigenvalues. Just to emphasize again, so for each value of sigma index here, I have one combination of values for the sigma. So for example, for sigma index, for sigma configuration 119, sigma 123 is 0, sigma 124 is -2, and so on and so forth. So each of these sigmas corresponds to a different, if you like, diffeomorphism invariant equivalence class of embeddings of edges at the vertex. Now, what's quite surprising is if we look at the smallest eigenvalues that arise for the five vertex, we notice that as we increase the spin, the maximum spin, which is incident on the vertex, then we see the volume eigenvalues decreasing with increasing spin for many of the sigma configurations. Here, there are also sigma configurations for which the minimum eigenvalue increases. So we see, in effect, both behaviors depending on the geometry of the edges incident on the vertex. Just to emphasize again, so for each value of the sigma here on this axis, I get one particular set of values for the sigmas, which implies some set of values for the signs, epsilon, and therefore gives me a diffeomorphism equivalence class of embeddings at the vertex. To give some idea of the effect of the sigma configurations, this is a histogram of the volume eigenvalue for a given sigma configuration for the five vertex. I have a number of these shown. We can see, in fact, that although the overall qualitative behavior is similar, we're seeing a non-trivial impact of the nature of the embedding on the volume spectrum. This here is a plot of all of the sigma configurations for the five vertex shown on the same plot. And in fact, we can see that there are quite different types of behaviors for different embeddings of the vertex. If I combine all the eigenvalues that we've computed for the five vertex, I get a histogram like so. We notice that there's an exponentially rising edge for small eigenvalues, and then there's a peak, and as we increase the J max, so each color here corresponds to a larger maximum spin. I should say that we've computed the volume eigenvalues for every possible set of spins on the vertices, which are consistent with some maximum. Now, and then here I'm showing the number of zeros, which is quite large. By the way, I'm neglecting the zeros in the spectrum on these histograms. And then we've computed some large number of eigenvalues. If I expand the region close to zero, I notice something quite interesting. In fact, it turns out that the spectral density is increasing as I look at smaller and smaller eigenvalues. And so because of the nature of the decreasing minimum eigenvalue as I increase the spins on the edges, what this is doing then is causing there to be a larger and larger number of very small eigenvalues close to zero. And so I'm getting some buildup of volume eigenvalues close to zero. If I look at the sixth vertex, we have similar behavior. Here's a plot of the largest eigenvalues for just a range of vertex geometries. This is a plot of the smallest eigenvalues. Again, I see a similar behavior. For many of them, the smallest eigenvalue is decreasing with maximum spin, and for others, the smallest eigenvalue is increasing with maximum spin. This is a histogram of the six-vertex spectrum. You may note that there's no lip, as in the five-vertex. I'm not getting a minimum in the spectral density for small lambda. But I expect that this is simply because of the fact that because there's an enormous number of sigma configurations for the six vertex, we're not able to carry out the simulation far enough in order to actually see this lip. But if we continue the simulation to larger and larger values of maximum spin, then I expect that we would see the same behavior for these higher valence vertices. And so then to conclude, so regarding the entropy bounds, so this suggestions that perhaps we should be looking at space-time discreteness to tell us something about the origin of the entropy bounds. And so I've shown you that the Susskind bound may arise from accounting of maximal elements in the future domain of dependence of a spherically symmetric region from a causal set. Regarding the emergence of continuum topology, it turns out that it's possible to extract spatial homology from a causal set by doing the computation that I described. And so this is now a useful tool for identifying manifold-like orders. And so then the idea is that we can continue to build on this by building a suite of tools which can extract macroscopic spacetime properties in this manner and then be able to more adequately study the nature of the causal sets that arise, say, from some non-trivial quantum dynamics. Regarding the spatial volume operator and loop quantum gravity, we've seen, first of all, that there is an important interplay between the embedding of the graph, embedding of the spin network vertex, and the recoupling of spins, which comes about from the structure of the volume operator. And furthermore, we notice that, in this sense, the spatial discreteness of loop quantum gravity is not completely decided, because we've seen that there does not seem to exist smallest non-zero eigenvalues in the spectrum. And so the idea then is that we can compute the volume operator on a supercomputer, and so it seems possible that now, since we have access to the volume operator, which is an important operator for many operators in the theory, we can start to perform computations in full loop quantum gravity. And to wrap up regarding cactus, so the one of the main points I wanted to convey to you is that numerical computing can be useful for gaining insight into quantum gravity, and that the cactus computational framework can be an excellent tool for facilitating these sorts of computations. And something that we may be wanting to do is be developing community code bases to address problems in various areas of quantum gravity. All right, thank you very much.
You mentioned earlier that you don't know any case which the use of entropy bounds is violated. But I think that if you consider a large enough two-sphere, close enough to initial singularity in a flat vertical universe, the entropy crossing the future of the black hole should be larger than that. Because I think Fisher and Susskind show that the past black hole will not violate the bound because it's too large, then it'll be cut off at the singularity.
Saying that, so if I consider a sphere near the future singularity, of an FRW universe?
The past singularity. Is there a string of past singularity?
Past singularity.
Where the past like when one flows. So the past, if you consider the Uso to be the past like on, it would be okay, but the future like on, it could be bothered.
Okay, I mean, okay, this may be possible. I mean, I didn't emphasize this in my talk, so that there may, in fact, be okay, flaws in covering attribute bound. Okay.
I just like to ask a little bit more about this last result about the bottom operator. Could you just say a couple things which bottom operator this is? And also, is there any different results about this small sponsor by like, four different families of the.
So, this is the F to Carl Lewandowski volume operator. So, it's true, yes, an important thing I should point out is that for the four vertex, we do in fact know that there is a smallest non-zero eigenvalue. And it's only when we consider larger valence vertices that we start to see this behavior. So if you wanted to argue that for some other reason that we should not expect to see valences greater than four in a three-dimensional space, then that would be some way around this result.